I'm happy that you're here. And in India, you may know that this greeting, it means namaste, which means I recognize and salute the divinity within you. My first book is called King of Travelers, Jesus Lost Years in India. And one of the places that I was teaching after my time in the Peace Corps, I was teaching in Pakistan, at Peshawar, Pakistan. I was working with refugees from the war in Afghanistan. And one of my classes in the evenings was a class of PhDs and medical doctors, and they called it the doctor's class. They were very well-educated Muslim people. And I remember that the students told me about a great Muslim traveler in the 1200s from Morocco named Ibn Battuta. And the story was Ibn Battuta had traveled from Morocco across North Africa all the way across to Arabia and then across over to India and China. And after many years, 30-some-odd years, he returned to Morocco. He was on his deathbed, and some admirers came and they said, "You, Ibn Battuta, are the greatest of all travelers." And the story was Ibn Battuta sat up on one elbow and he smiled and shook his finger and he said, "No. If you learn the truth about Hazrat Isa, Prophet Jesus, you will find that Jesus is King of Travelers." And the phrase King of Travelers, that stuck in my mind. And they also told me that the Holy Quran of the Muslims refers to Jesus as the Prince of Travelers and the Great Traveler. This was in 2003. This was at the International UFO Congress. I was a vendor. I wrote my first book, King of Travelers, in 1999. So at that time I was telling about 1994, I'd not even begun to write my book. I didn't even have a good idea in mind. But in 1999, I wrote my first book, King of Travelers, and in 2003, I was attending the International UFO Congress at Laughlin, Nevada. Week-long event that time. I was there all week, and toward the beginning of the week, there came an interesting gentleman in the mornings to my vendor's table, and he was a screenwriter from Southern California. And so he liked my Jesus in India material, and he bought a copy of my first book, and so he kept coming back every morning. About the middle of the week, he brought a distinguished-looking gentleman, and the distinguished-looking gentleman he was asking questions, and he said, "You don't know who I am, do you?" And I said, "No, but I get the idea you're someone important." And he introduced himself as Paul Davids, one of the two executive producers of the movie Roswell that premiered in 1994 on the Showtime cable channel. Roswell starred Martin Sheen, Kyle MacLachlan, Dwight Yoakam. It was a theatrical movie that is the reenacting of a dramatic story. And the Roswell movie, it was really well made. Paul, by the way, has a cameo in it as an army photographer there at Roswell. And the line he says is, "Hey, this one just moved," talking about the alien bodies. So what happened was that I met Paul Davids, and he bought a copy of my book, King of Travelers, and he read it in about the next 2 days, and he kept dropping by at various times saying, "Would you like to have lunch? Do you want to have coffee? Do you want to have dinner tonight?" And he would be asking me questions about what if we were to make a movie, either a theatrical movie with actors and a script, or a documentary movie based on King of Travelers, based on Jesus in India. Did I think it could be commercially successful? I think it would be successful. In fact, it could be phenomenally successful, especially a good, well-crafted theatrical movie. That's my opinion. So what happened was Paul and I became friends, and he gave me his business card, a couple of his business cards, and he said, "Do you ever get out to California?" And I said, "Oh, about every 1 or 2 years I'll get out there, spend a few weeks or a couple of months in California." He said, "Next time you're in California, give me a call." And he asked, did I know when I had been to India twice at that time. And he asked if I was going to go back and do more Jesus in India research. And I said, "Well, I plan to." And he said, "Talk with me before you do that." And I said, "Okay." And so coming up then, it was summer in 2003 and late June, and I was out in Southern California. I gave Paul Davids a call, and Paul was saying, "Well, how about we get together next week and we'll have lunch and we set up the time and the events. Anyway, and then they arrived, they sat down, and we all had a copy of my first book on the table, and I looked out at across through the windows across Hollywood Boulevard, and there's Grauman's Chinese Theater. And I looked at them, I thought, I'm sitting with a movie producer and a screenwriter, and we're here, and there's Grauman's Chinese Theater, and it was the 4th of July. And I was like, whoa. I thought about Leo, about the session, the future life, future time progression with Leo. And it came completely true. And it's like, whoa. And they were like, are you okay? And I said, well, you're very open-minded, I'll tell you. And I told them about that with Leo. And they said, was there more? I said, yeah, I better not say it now, but there's more. And then 2 years later, another part of the progressions was the 4th of July, year 2005. I was back in India. The movie producer was with me with our filming team, and we were filming the movie. And that one was right on also. And there's more good stuff. Anyway, I can't talk about it, but there's more good stuff. But this is Paul Davids on the Ganges during our 6 weeks of the filming in India. And this is one of Paul's more famous movies that he was one of the two executive producers of this movie, Roswell. If you never have seen it, it's a really well-crafted, well-made movie. The reenacting of the events around the UFO crash that was outside of Roswell, New Mexico, in July of 1947, and it's a dramatic story. It's a great story, great movie. And here we go back, jumping back, and let me. I think you can figure where this is and who's involved. The boy, he's 12 years old. He's in the temple in Jerusalem. It's just following Passover. And the man with the white beard, that's a famous, historically a famous, legendary Jewish high priest and teacher. And it'll come back to me in a moment. He was a mentor for Jesus. And then off to the right, you can see those people. Mary, Mother Mary, and Joseph, the surrogate father, off to the right. Joseph doesn't look like he's particularly happy about things, and Mother Mary is very excited, but Jesus is giving wonderfully profound spiritual answers to these very difficult teachings that were puzzling to the Jewish teachers. And we don't know about Jesus for the next 18 years. There's only the one transitional passage at the end of the second chapter of Luke, 52nd verse, and Jesus increased in wisdom and in stature and in favor with God and man. So Jesus jumps from being 12 years old to being 30 years old. And there's no real explanation. And the way that... I think that in the early New Testament, I'm sure that in the early first 100 years of the Christian religion and the forming of the Christian religion, they knew very well about how that Jesus had spent time in India during the missing years, particularly the missing teenage years, how that he had studied Hinduism at the Jagannath Temple for at least 6 years, in eastern India at Puri, and the other travels of Jesus, how that Jesus has studied both Hinduism and Buddhism in India, Nepal, Tibet, and but it's kind of like this: the early church fathers had the thinking that they felt that if they were to tell the truth about that, let the truth be known, it would compromise Jesus. It would make Jesus. Make their new religion look less grand than they wanted it to be. In other words, if the cornerstone of the Christian religion, Jesus Christ, studied other religions like Hinduism and Buddhism and respected them, then they felt that might not look good. It's kind of like if you go to interview the head of Ford Motors at the end of the interview and he says, I've got to go to my car and go somewhere. What kind of car is he going to get in?
Chevy.
Head of Ford Motors, he's going to get in a Ford. So that was the thinking in the early Christian church. When I was 18 years old, I met a young man from Hopkinsville, Kentucky, who introduced me to the work of Edgar Cayce. How many of you are familiar with Edgar Cayce? And the Edgar Cayce material, I have a great respect for it. Started reading the books by Edgar Cayce and reading about his medical readings, his trance readings, and how that in the past life readings that Cayce did, there were numerous times, at least 9 times in the readings, that he did a reading for someone and said, you had a past lifetime 2,000 years ago in India, and during that lifetime, you knew young Jesus in India. Which brings me to an interesting point. I was born quite a time after Cayce died, but Dr. Leo Sprinkle did a trance reading for me one time. I had asked Leo, I'll show you his picture later, but Dr. Leo Sprinkle up in Laramie, Wyoming, who's very well known and very well respected in the UFO research field. Dr. Leo Sprinkle, he not only does hypnosis about UFO missing time and past lifetimes, he also can go into the self-trance state, like Edgar Cayce, and his spirit guides speak through him, and they have access to the Akashic Records. And the spirit guides have limitless information because they can contact the Akashic Records, the same place that Edgar Cayce went in his readings about past lifetimes. And so what happened was that I asked Leo one time when I was there at Laramie. I was doing several hypnosis sessions over several days, and I asked him, I said, let's do a half-an-hour trance reading on one question. And the one question is, 2,000 years ago, did I have a past lifetime in India? And did I have a past lifetime anywhere on Earth 2,000 years ago? And if I did I ever meet Jesus or have any dealings with him? And Leo, in the trance state, said, yes, 2,000 years ago, you were a young man living in northern India, the Himalayan region. You were a young Hindu priest named Lamas Gupta. And you were still a young man in your early 20s when one summer there came a 16-year-old boy into the area where you were in the Himalayas. The 16-year-old boy wanted to travel to a remote ashram to visit. And you were going there, and you volunteered to take him. My work in that lifetime was that I knew the Himalayas and the paths very well, and I carried documents and messages between the ashrams and monasteries in the Himalayas, and I also guided travelers, especially holy travelers. And what happened was that I met this 16-year-old boy who needed a guide, and he was a foreigner. He was a Hebrew boy. He'd been studying at the Jagannath Temple at Puri. And the boy was Jesus, 16-year-old Jesus. And he and I walked together for many days as we were traveling, going to that remote ashram. And I've done a lot of that in this lifetime, including in the Himalayas. I've done a lot of walking. I walked to Everest Base Camp one time, 150 miles, 21 days. And I've done a lot of other walking in mountains, and I've done a lot of mountain climbs. I've climbed maybe 15 or 20 high mountains. But what happened was with walking that way out in the open air in the mountains, one of the great things is you're breathing really well, and you're with other people who maybe have similar consciousness, and you can talk as much or as little as you wish. And I'm sure with young Jesus, there were just wonderful conversations. And Leo said that I had the impression that he was a young avatar, a very spiritually advanced being, and that I didn't know who he would become, but I had the sense that he would become someone very significant. How could Jesus have gone to India? Some people say, how could he have gone there? India is about 4,000 miles away from the Mediterranean. How could he have gone? What route? What way would there have been? Silk. The most ancient, famous trade route in the world for thousands of years, and still now, it's called United Nations Highway 1, the Silk Road. And the merchants from the Mediterranean area, European countries all over the Mediterranean, those merchants would get together in caravans, 200, 300 of them in a group with camels, horses, and with some soldiers, some fighters to protect them. But they would travel in groups because of the safety in numbers, 200 or 300 in a group, and they would travel on the Silk Road. And the Silk Road had several variations, but this is one of the variations of it. But going basically across ancient Persia, now Iran, across Afghanistan, and what's now Pakistan, northern Pakistan, into India. And one of the routes is here. This is the route that Marco Polo and his father and uncle took. Marco Polo in the 1270s, they took that route that goes through the tip of Afghanistan, the Wakhan Corridor, the tip of Afghanistan, the high pass, the Wakhjir Pass up at 17,000 feet, and that tip of the thumb touches over into western China, and proceeding on that way, all the way over to eastern China. There's a great desert here called the Taklamakan. The Taklamakan. And the Taklamakan, the singing sands. The Taklamakan, it means once in, never out. The caravans either, and even now, they either skirt it on the south or skirt it on the north, but they don't go across it. But ending up here over in eastern China, Khan Malik, and the silk growers, they would sell the merchants the silk cocoons in big burlap bags, big sacks full of silk cocoons, and then the merchants would take those over to western India to the Punjab. Panjab, ek do teen char panch. Panjab, the land of the five rivers, the Punjab. And they would have the silk weavers, and there's still silk weavers now, many of them, in the Punjab. And they would weave the silk into beautiful cloth, and then they would take bales of the cloth and bring the cloth to wealthy families in the Mediterranean and Europe. And but that's how, the Silk Road. So one of the traditions is that Jesus, at about the age of 13 years old, that he joined a caravan on the Silk Road as a caravan helper, and that he traveled the Silk Road that way as a caravan helper. And another one of the traditions is that there was a prince named Ravana from eastern India, from the state there called Orissa, and that Prince Ravana was in at the Feast of the Passover in Jerusalem at that time when Jesus was 12 years old and went missing from his parents, and that Prince Ravana offered to become the sponsor. The story is that Prince Ravana and his helpers, they went up after that event at the temple, they went up to Nazareth and stayed a week in Nazareth, and every night they'd put on a banquet. Prince Ravana would put on a banquet for the entire town of Nazareth, pay for all the food, and the guest of honor was young Jesus and his parents. And then that Prince Ravana was making the offer, I will be his patron. He may return to India with my group, with our group on a caravan. He may return with us, and I will be his patron and sponsor. I'll take care of him and see that he's safe. And he may come to Orissa, and he may study there at the Jagannath Temple at Puri. So that's one of the traditions, that Jesus had a sponsor, Prince Ravana. But however it happened that's the route, the Silk Road. And it's interesting that about every 10 miles there would be a place to spend the night, springs source of water, a place to camp under palm trees, things like that, a place to spend the night, and then continue the next day. And Afghanistan. How can I tell you about Afghanistan? I was in the Peace Corps there, and I did not know what I was getting into. It's a wonderful picture book by Roland and Sabrina Michaud from France. Wonderful photographs. But Afghanistan, I have military friends who've been over there recently, and sure, there are people with smartphones and more electronic things in the cities, especially in Kabul. But you get away from the cities, and in many ways, it's like traveling back, far back in time. Very different consciousness, a very different way of life. And I know that as a young Peace Corps volunteer, it was really a difficult situation for all of us who were there in the Peace Corps. This is one place in the central part of Afghanistan, Bandi Amir, the spring of the saint, and it's about very deep springs and a beautiful place. And these are some people walking along there. This is on the road going to Bamiyan, and I'm told that I had one of my students recently, several months back, at Defense Language Institute, English Language Center in San Antonio at Lackland Air Force Base. One of my students from Afghanistan, he pulled out his smartphone. I asked, where are you from? And he said, he's from Afghanistan. We have quite a few there from Afghanistan. And I said, that's wonderful. And I told him, I said, Manba Farsi, Manba Afghanistan, Zindagi Mekadim. I lived in Afghanistan. I lived there for a year, and we were talking a little. And he showed me pictures on his smartphone, and he said, with the help of the United Nations, they're now rebuilding the giant Buddhas at Bamiyan. So I'm very happy to hear that. It's a wonderful place at Bamiyan with the giant Buddhas. And this is in northwestern India at Kashmir. This is Srinagar. This is Dal Lake, and on Dal Lake there are hundreds of these houseboats, and it's a fantastic place. Well, what happened when I was... this is a book, Christ in Kashmir, by a local man who at that time was a newspaper editor named Aziz Kashmiri. And there's the newer printing of Christ in Kashmir, Aziz Kashmiri, and... when I first met him, I was a young Peace Corps volunteer, and he was still the editor of the local newspaper in Srinagar called the Roshni, the Light. A very strange bottle of beer. Connection with Jesus in India. Here's can you read that? By Krishnamurti. Whenever a human being sets out to find the real truth about something, he must first arm himself with great courage, because he may not find what he is expecting. And it has certainly been that way with my research about the evidence about Jesus in India. And what happened that ties in with this, here's Afghanistan right there, Pakistan, India, and that there was a beer at the time that was brewed at Murray, Pakistan, just outside of Rawalpindi. And that beer at the time, the label, what happened was that I, in the Peace Corps in Afghanistan, there, of course, at that time was no alcohol. You couldn't go to a bar or a tavern to buy a drink like beer or whiskey or wine or anything like that. You couldn't get any kind of an alcoholic drink at the time I was in Afghanistan, except... Americans and other foreigners could go to the American Embassy in Kabul, Afghanistan. They had an embassy annex, and there in the embassy annex, there was a bar for foreigners. And so, and the embassy grounds are considered the soil of that country. In other words, that's considered part of the United States, that small area of the American Embassy and the annex. And so they had a Pakistani Christian bartender handling the alcoholic drinks, and he was doing the bartending. And he would wear a turban and really interesting outfit. And Pakistani Christians have to go by Christian names, so he was called Mr. Wilson. So I was talking with him one day after work, and I'd gone over there to have a beer over at the annex. And it was quiet at about 5 in the afternoon, pretty quiet. And I looked at one of the bottles of beer behind the counter there, and the label said, I said, can you hand me that one? And he did, and it said Murray Lager, M-U-R-R-E-E, Murray Lager. And I said, oh, I tell about this in the first chapter of my book, Murray Lager. And I said, oh, it's named after an Englishman. He said, no, sahib, named after Mary. Oh, Mary was an English woman. No, sahib, named after Mary, mother of Jesus. And I said, Pakistan is a Muslim country, and it's unusual. It surprised me that there would be a brewery there that brews beer, and it's pretty good beer. And I said, but it's named Murray. I said, why would it be named? You're saying it's named after the mother of Jesus? Murray comes from Mary. And he said, exactly, sahib. And I said, why would it have that name? He said, because her tomb, her grave is there. She is buried at that place. Her tomb is there on hilltop. My Marida Astan, resting place of Mother Mary, the grave of Mary, Mother of Jesus Christ. And so on this hilltop in northern Pakistan, he was saying that's where Jesus, the mother of that Mary, the mother of Jesus, is buried. Murray, Pakistan. And the local springs there was named after her, and then the town grew up, and later there was the brewery and so on. But I asked about that, and he said, Sahib, some people, especially some Muslim people, believe Jesus did not die on cross. He was in state of near death and put into tomb of Joseph of Arimathea, but half dead, half alive. And that he had helpers who came in through back tunnel entrance. They ministered for 3 days and nights, medicines, ointments, treatments. And after 3 days and three nights, he was well enough to get up, and they all crawled out the back tunnel entrance, and he lived. He made appearances, and he told me how that Jesus, later after he made his appearances to the disciples and to others, then with a disguise, wearing a disguise, he went northward up to Damascus, and for 2 years lived in a safe house in Damascus, which I think may have belonged to his great uncle Joseph of Arimathea, a very wealthy, influential man. But that Jesus stayed in Damascus the next 2 years and recuperated, and it was during that time that a fanatical man named Saul of Tarsus, who was persecuting Christians in that early time. Saul of Tarsus was on his way up to Damascus to try to catch any of these new Christians up there. And then the story that I was told was that Jesus heard about that and said, I'll take care of him, and went to see a fireworks maker and took fireworks about 1 day's walk south of Damascus along the road, and had his thing set up, and then used a jar of camphor, which is very flammable, and was all set up and struck sparks into the camphor, made a big bright light, and then some fireworks went off, hissing and shooting up into the air, and the Saul of Tarsus was up in front of the group and got blinded, or temporarily blinded and astonished, and Jesus got up on a rock, on a boulder, and read him the riot act, like it says in the New Testament. Saul, Saul, why do you persecute me? Get up, go into the city, and learn how you should live, like that. And then Jesus disappeared into the night. But anyway, this was not something that I wanted to find about the tomb of Jesus. And of course, there's no official tomb of Mother Mary in the Holy Land, in Israel. There's no official tomb of Mother Mary, and I always wondered about that. I thought, she's important. Why wouldn't they have kept track of where she was buried, Mother Mary? And But it's on a hilltop there in northern Pakistan in the Himalayas. And it's the military has built a military communications tower there. But her tomb, the tomb of Mother Mary, is still revered by many of the local people. And the local Muslims revere her also because Mother Mary is mentioned in the Holy Quran as a holy woman, the mother of an important prophet in the Holy Quran, Hazrat Isa, Prophet Jesus, one of the important prophets in the Holy Quran. This is a Russian explorer and researcher, Nicholas Notovich, and in the 1880s, Nicholas Notovich was traveling in what's now northern India, and Nicholas Notovich was visiting, was traveling by horse with a group of travelers in 1887. He was thrown from his horse and landed on a rocky road, and his leg was fractured. No hospital nearby, but they took him to this Himis Monastery, a Tibetan Buddhist monastery that's in Ladakh in far northwestern India, up close to the border with Tibet. This Himis Gompa Monastery, Nicholas Notovich was there for a number of weeks recovering from the fractured leg. The monks liked him, and they knew about his Christian beliefs, and they volunteered some information. They said, "We have an ancient Tibetan manuscript in the Pali language which tells about your Jesus being here and other places in India. Do you want to see it?" And they brought him he said yes, and they brought him the manuscript. And the manuscript is called The Life. The area there looks like this. Very high country. They can grow barley and some other crops up here in the high valleys. Up there in Himis Monastery is up at about around 14,000 feet elevation, high location. But what happened was that they brought him out the manuscript and showed him the manuscript, which the Tibetan type scripts, which are unbound. And they're in long sheets, and they have a wooden piece on the top and the bottom with ribbons holding it together. And the manuscript, this is in a book by Elizabeth Clare Prophet, and we'll see the cover of that book later. But the manuscript, which they had translated into English, is called The Life of Saint Isa, the Best of the Sons of Men. And Nicholas Notovich, after he returned to Europe, he published his book called The Unknown Life of Jesus Christ. And you can still find that book. There are modern printings of it. And it has the entire text of The Life of Saint Isa. It's telling about there was no question about the authenticity of the text, and the text was 2,000 years old. And it starts out like this. The manuscript goes on to describe that, I don't know if you can read it very well here, journeyed beyond the Sindh through the country of the five rivers, the Punjab and the Rajputan, left the misguided admirers of Jain and visited Jagannath, that's the Jagannath Temple in the province of Orsis, now called Orissa, spent 6 years in Jagannath. And that's where we get the expression rolling like a juggernaut, that once a year they have a big festival there. We'll see some floats later, but the big festival is called Rath Yatra. And they have Rath Yatra every summer. And at the Rath Yatra festival, they have big wooden carts that are as big as a small room. And they have papier-mâché images of Lord Jagannath and his brother and sister, and they roll those for long distances. Sometimes the tradition, the British soldiers and so on would see this in the 1700s, 1800s, and so on like that, and other foreign people. And the tradition was that if someone fell down in front of it, it kept moving. And so the expression formed rolling like a juggernaut. In other words, not stopping for anything. And this one, we'll go on from here. Jesus in India. Hazrat Mirza Ghulam Ahmad of Gadian he was the founder, the leader of the Ahmadiyya Muslims, the sect of Islam called the Ahmadiyyas. And Hazrat Mirza Ghulam Ahmad, he wrote this book, Jesus in India, in 1899, more than 100 years ago. And he had visions and psychic information that Jesus had visited India as a youth, and he wrote this book about Jesus in India. And Hazrat Mirza, he made a prophecy also. He said that in the latter part of the 20th century, there will come young people from Europe and America who will come to India and do research about evidence, finding evidence that young Jesus lived in India. And then they will return home and write books about Jesus in India and give talks and spread the information, share the information about Jesus in India. And so I was invited I was speaking one time at a Ahmadiyya Muslim conference in Houston, and one of the elders stood up and pointed at me and said, "Here is the fulfillment of prophecy. Here's someone who did what he said, what Hazrat Mirza said would happen." And art of Nicholas Roerich. Nicholas Roerich was another Russian explorer. He was a wonderful artist, fantastic artist. He made thousands of beautiful paintings in his lifetime. In New York City, there is a Nicholas Roerich Museum, and it's on, I believe, West 107th Street in New York City. If you want to see the website, it's www.roerich.org, and they have. Every time I'm going on an overseas trip and going to be crossing the Atlantic, going back to India or someplace like that, I arrange to arrive in New York a day early, and I stay at the HI Youth Hostel on Amsterdam Avenue, just northwest of Central Park. And I arrive a day early so I can spend a whole day at the Nicholas Roerich Museum. And it's in a brownstone, one of the brownstone buildings there on West 107th Street, not too many blocks northwest from Central Park. And the Roerich paintings are fantastic. The reason I show Roerich also, these are some of the paintings. This one is called Stronghold of the Spirit. And I believe on the rock there, if anyone can read Tibetan, I believe that is Om Mani Padme Hum. Blessed is the jewel within the lotus. Blessed is the human spirit within the human body. Om Mani Padme Hum. And yeah, this one is called Stronghold of the Spirit. And this one, I love this one too. This one is called Remember, painted in 1924. There's so many places like this in the Himalayas. I mean, I'm a mountain climber, and I've climbed in different countries, different places, and I've climbed Kilimanjaro over in East Africa. I've climbed the highest one in North America, Denali, also called Mount McKinley, 20,320 feet, 14 days up and 6 days down. But in the Himalayas, if you love mountains, it blows your mind, because there'll be some peaks that are 26,000 feet and higher, and Everest is 29,035. But there'll be 26,000 and higher foot peaks, and then there'll be a drop down to the valley floor, might be 3,000 or 4,000 feet elevation. Just tremendous sweep of beautiful country, tremendous area. But this one is called Remember. The Lost Years of Jesus. This is how I first found out about Nicholas Roerich and his beautiful paintings. One other thing about Nicholas Roerich that we put in our movie, you'll see in the Jesus in India movie, that in the 1920s, Nicholas Roerich, he was living with his wife and children in India, northern India, around Manali and Kulu, that area, and the Himalayan foothills. And one of his trips visiting New York, Nicholas Roerich spoke with newspaper people from different newspapers in New York, and he was telling about how that Roerich he himself was a witness to the Life of St. Esau document that we were talking about earlier at the Hemis Monastery. They showed that document to Nicholas Roerich. Nicholas Roerich reported about that, told about it to the newspapers in New York, and it was big news for a while. Document found giving evidence about young Jesus in India. But some of the traditional Christian people involved with supporting the Roerich Museum there in New York City, some of them said, "We don't like this. We don't want him in India. We don't want Jesus in India. Even if it's true, you know, we don't like it." And so, consequently, they said, "If you keep talking about Jesus in India, we're going to stop giving financial support every year to the museum." And so, then Roerich knew when to be quiet, and so he was quiet about the subject after that. But he was a witness, and we tell about that in the movie. This is a wonderful book by Elizabeth Clare Prophet, and I don't know if she's still living, but she and her husband, I believe his name was Mark Prophet, and they were the heads of the Church Universal and Triumphant up at Livingston, Montana. But this is a wonderful book, and she tells about the discoveries of Notovitch, Abhedananda, we'll hear about him, Roerich, and Kaspari. We'll hear about all of them. That these are some people who were visitors to the that area of northern Pakistan and northwestern India, and this is one a professor from a university out in Southern California, and we're told that he in 1974 was shown the same document, the Life of St. Esau. Jesus Lived in India by Holger Kersten. This is a wonderful book about Jesus in India, his unknown life before and after the crucifixion. And Holger Kersten, when we were filming our Jesus in India movie, that we invited Holger Kersten to appear in our movie. And Holger Kersten, he has now become a renunciate. He's become a monk at a monastery in Switzerland, and he politely told us that he has turned his back on the world. And he thanked us for the invitation, but he said that he is a renunciate and he has turned his back on the world. And also, this is a wonderful book, The Aquarian Gospel of Jesus the Christ by Levi Dowling. And Levi Dowling was a chaplain in the American Civil War. And Levi Dowling was in the Union Army, chaplain in the Union Army. And in the years after the Civil War, Levi Dowling would stay up late at night and would go into deep meditations. And in those deep meditations, Levi Dowling found that he could contact the Akashic Record, the same place Edgar Cayce later contacted, and many other great visionaries and mystics have been able to go to that other dimension, to the Akashic Records. Levi Dowling, in the Akashic Records, he would seek out material about young Jesus in India. And he came up with very detailed information about young Jesus in India. And this wonderful book is still in print, The Aquarian Gospel of Jesus the Christ, has a different cover, usually has now a different cover. But this book has, the biggest part of this book is detailed information about Jesus in India. And it goes into, by the way, there's some little tidbits in here that, can you imagine? It gives in here information. It mentions the name of the street in Nazareth where Joseph and Mary had their house. Marmion Way. Marmionway. Marmion Way was the name of the street in Nazareth where Joseph and Mary had their house. And a little tidbit, a little coincidental tidbit, maybe it's no coincidence, in Los Angeles, where Paul Davids and his wife Hollis have their home on a hilltop in Highland Park, within half a mile of Mount Washington, where the headquarters of Self-Realization Fellowship, the Yogananda Group, is. Just a few blocks, three, four blocks from Paul Davids' house, is a street called Marmion Way. And I told that to Paul, and I showed him in the book. He's like, what? The streets and avenues near Paul's house tend to coincidentally have some connection with movies he's made, amazingly enough. But this is a marvelous book, and another little detail is when 12-year-old Jesus disappeared from his parents, and the surrogate father Joseph, they were searching for him and they were asking some of the guards of the temple there in Nazareth, and Joseph gave the description something like, "I'm looking for my 12-year-old son. He's a fair-looking lad. He has reddish brown hair and fair blue eyes." And that struck me about the blue eyes and the reddish brown hair. And that later matches other descriptions about what Jesus looked like. This also describes in here the one little tidbit that of information that ties in exactly with another document we'll talk about called the Talmud of Emmanuel, which I believe and some other researchers believe is the original book of Matthew before it was censored and altered and redacted in more than 200 places. But what this says, by the way, the ruler of Judea at the time that young Jesus was growing up was not Herod the Great. Herod the Great had already died. It was one of the sons of Herod named Herod Antipas. Herod Antipas was the ruler at that time of Judea, the time that baby Jesus was born. And the story about cruel King Herod putting to death all of the newborn baby boys, that story, it's easy to make up terrible stories about Adolf Hitler now, you know, right? Well, they wanted in the early Christian church when they were doing their censoring and altering and so on, putting together the New Testament from, I believe, the Talmud of Emmanuel original document. One of the things they put in there was about King Herod the Great giving the order to kill the baby boys, you know, and make him even more hated than he already was. But this is a wonderful book. Describes in detail about the 6 years that Jesus spent in his teenage years at the Jagannath Temple at Puri in eastern India, and many other of the wonderful events. And that one of his good friends, by the way, was a young Hindu priest named Lamas. Lamaas. And I don't know if that was me. You know, I was maybe a different Lamas up in the Himalayas. But much of the story, there are connections with extraterrestrial beings. We're not alone in the universe. And the Talmud of Emmanuel goes into considerable detail about benevolent extraterrestrials, many of them who have visited the Earth. By the way, I'll show you, this is something we're going to be seeing in the coming months throughout the winter, that this is Orion the Hunter. I don't know if you can see the three bright stars in the belt. That's his right shoulder, left foot, right foot. There's his head. He's holding. There's his left arm, his right arm. Over here it is, Sirius, the dog star, the brightest star in the northern hemisphere. Sirius, the dog star. It's Canis Major, the big dog. So here's Canis Major, the big dog, with a very bright star, Sirius. Sirius, the dog, is chasing Orion the Hunter, and that's no bull. There's over here the horns of the V of Taurus the bull and a bright star Aldebaran. And then to the right of that is the Pleiades, the seven sisters. So Sirius the dog is chasing Orion the Hunter, and that's no bull, say the seven sisters. This is a little children's expression. But it's a beautiful constellation. I saw it just a week or so ago up in the hill country. But there's a connection, oddly enough, we'll see more about it here, with the Belt of Orion. Human visitors from the Belt of Orion landing in the Mojave Desert in the 1950s, and I'll show you the information, meeting with two twin boys out in the Mojave Desert in the 1950s and 1960s, giving them information, including about Jesus in India. That's incredible how that happened, of how we found, Paul Davids and I found out about that. And there's even, well, I'll come back to the details about that, but they even told a real stinger of a detail. It's like, how did they know about that? And it coincided with other things, and I'll tell about that. This is what one thing I did not want to find. This is when I was in Srinagar, that is in the connection with that tomb of Mary in northern Pakistan, is that Jesus may have survived the crucifixion. And that he may have, if that is true, that he, after the death of his mother in what's now northern Pakistan, and her burial, then Jesus continued eastward through the mountain passes, another 100 miles or so, and went and arrived where he had been before, in his years before as a youth, he went to Kashmir. And when he arrived, and this tradition is that when he arrived back in one little tidbit, is that he had a donkey he was traveling with for some time, quite some time. And between Mary, the Murray, where he buried his mother, and between this location, Kashmir, somewhere in the high mountain passes, his donkey died. And the story was that local villagers helped him, and they gave Egyptian-type burial rites for the donkey, who was considered a holy animal because he'd helped Jesus. But this was, Jesus arrived, the tradition is that Jesus, when he arrived back in, after his mother died, and he arrived in Kashmir, he was in a place called Pahalgam, Shepherd's Meadow, and it was, so when his mother died in the springtime and was buried on that hilltop, and there's more interesting little details about how she'd get a couple of women to help her up, even though she was sick, and she'd go to the hilltop, and Jesus would come up carrying a container of wine and some cups, and they would sit on the hilltop among the blossoming fruit trees, watch the sunset there to the west across the Himalayas, and drink wine and watch the sunset. But in Pahalgam, Shepherd's Meadow, that when Jesus returned, the tradition is that Jesus was that he spent a couple of months in about May, June, late spring. He was living there at Pahalgam, and he was doing some healings for the local villagers, and he was helping the local villagers, and they gave him a shepherd's hut to live in the couple of months that he was there. And the story was that in the month of June, he had gone into a meadow one nice day in this beautiful high country there, like being up way up in the mountains in Colorado, high grassy areas, meadows, beautiful conifer, pine trees, those kind of trees, snow-capped mountain peaks in the area, beautiful high country. And the shepherds grazed their sheep in that area. But Jesus' story was that he was, in about the month of June, that he had spread a blanket in a meadow of wildflowers, and he might have been sitting in the shade of some trees, but he had gathered some small stones, maybe the size of acorns, and put them into two piles on the blanket in front of him. He was sitting there, cross-legged, maybe in the lotus position, and he was sitting there, and using the power of the mind and the spirit, he was pointing his finger at the piles of stones, and one by one he would levitate the stones to the other pile. And he was doing that one by one, levitating the stones, the small objects, and like Yoda doing in the Star Wars movies, or like there are many traditions and stories about Tibetan holy people being able to levitate objects and moving objects through the power of the mind and the power of the spirit. It's talked about in a lot of traditions. It's like walking on water. There are holy people in India. There are traditions about various people walking on water. But anyway, Jesus, the tradition is that he was levitating those stones like that. And that up behind him, who comes walking along? The king of Kashmir, Shalibahan. King Shalibahan, it was a nice spring day, and King Shalibahan called some of his helpers, and they said, get a couple of the chariots ready. I'd like us to go to Pahalgam, go out to Shepherd's Meadow, and it's a nice day. Go out there, bring a picnic lunch, and we'll go out there for the day. So they went out in their chariots, and they were walking in the meadow, and King Shalibahan came up behind and said, oh, this must be a holy man. What is he doing? And saw him levitating the stones from one pile to the other. And King Shalibahan must have thought, oh, this is a holy man. This is the real thing. Oh, I've got to meet this guy. And so King Shalibahan met Jesus and invited him, said, Do you ever come to Srinagar? And you know where I live? You know the palace in Srinagar? Well, come there sometime and we'll have lunch. And so a few weeks after that, Jesus took him up on the offer. He went there and had lunch with the king. And King Shalibahan made him an offer. He said, I'd like to give you a job as my spiritual advisor. And it's a simple job. I'll give you a house to live in, and so you'll be living nearby, and every day around lunch, come over and have lunch with me. I'll have guests, I'll have diplomats, royalty, different foreign visitors, and so on like that. And you have lunch with us, and just kind of relax and tune in on things. And then after the visitors would leave, the king would talk privately with Jesus, kind of like if you remember those Star Trek shows, who always was at the side of the captain, the good psychic, the intuitive who could pick up on things psychically, and the captain could ask advice. Well, the king would ask Jesus, well, the diplomat from Mesopotamia, what did you think about him? Or the young prince from Siam, what did you think about him? Or this princess, or this one, or that one, what do you think? So Jesus was the spiritual advisor to King Shalibahan for more than 40 years. And that the king fixed him up with a, asked if he needed a housekeeper, and young Jesus, he was still in his 30s at the time, Jesus said, yes, I'd like a housekeeper. So he fixed him up with, the story is the king arranged for 50 young women to come the next day there to the palace, and Jesus looked them over, and he chose one. She probably had a good aura. One of them named Marianne, and that Marianne became his housekeeping lady, and kept his house clean, washed his clothes, cooked his meals, and did those kinds of things. And that later on, they got to know each other better, and they fell in love and decided to get married. And they had several children. And that Jesus lived to about the age of 110. And according to the local tradition, this is where he's buried. Look at the feet here. You see the marks in the feet? Crucifixion marks. Crucifixion scars. And incidentally, Paramahansa Yogananda, in, I believe it was in the 1930s, Paramahansa Yogananda visited a great a stigmatist, a Catholic sister named Therese Newman of Connersruth, Bavaria. And Therese Newman, every year, especially around Easter time, she would go into an ecstatic bleeding of the wounds of Jesus. And the blood would, a lot of blood would be coming out of her hands and her feet. And I think also from where the thorns pierce the top part of the head. But she would be bleeding profusely. And this is in some of the books about Yogananda, describing how that Yogananda and his some of his helpers were there. They were on a round-the-world trip, but they were going passing through Connersruth, Bavaria. They stopped there. They were there at the time, and that the story is that the other nuns were helping wipe away the blood from Therese Newman, and as they would wipe the blood away from the hands, Yogananda got over close and took a close look, and as the blood would be wiped away, the shape of the nail wound was a square shape. And you see why that would be?
Square nails.
Why didn't they have round mill nails 2,000 years ago? They didn't have that process to make round mill nails. The nails 2,000 years ago were made by hand by a blacksmith. And they had to have four sides, four-sided nails. You see what I'm saying? That's just one of the small things that I would not have imagined. Yes?
Then there's Jesus' progeny alive today?
Indeed. The newspaper editor that we saw a while ago, Aziz Kashmiri, he didn't tell me, and I only found out later from one of my good friends, another researcher, Dr. Jim Deardorff, said that the newspaper editor, told me the newspaper editor that you met, Aziz Kashmiri, he's one of the biological descendants. And there are others. I can show you some other pictures and so on like that. But that's part of the progeny. And the other part of the progeny, you know, there's the tradition. Perhaps you may have heard the tradition that Mary Magdalene and Jesus may have been secretly married, perhaps about a year before the crucifixion, and that after the crucifixion, at the time of the crucifixion. And then the great storm was coming in, and that Jesus had slumped on the cross. The centurion Caius Longinus, and I can go on about all this for hours and hours and hours, more and more details. But Caius Longinus, the centurion, that he was sympathetic to Jesus' teachings and liked Jesus, and that with the spear he made only a superficial cut to the hip. And that with the superficial cut, out came the clear lymph that looks like water mixed with the blood, and it's in the state of a person who is either dead or half dead, someone nearly dead. Their circulation has been slowed down. But when Caius Longinus made that superficial cut to the hip, and out came the lymph mixed with the blood, and Caius Longinus said, "There's no flinch. He's dead. Let's go back to the barracks." And it was Joseph of Arimathea, the great uncle, who could perhaps see auras and could see that he was still alive, even though he had slumped on the cross, and that he was still living. And then Joseph of Arimathea quickly got the permission from his friend Pontius Pilate, and then Pontius Pilate was surprised that a young, strong man like Jesus, without having his legs broken, had died. The key to dying quickly on the cross is to have your legs broken so you cannot keep pushing up to keep breathing properly. And then Mary Magdalene, thinking that he was dead, she quickly, we don't know how quickly, but pretty soon, apparently, left with some other of her female friends. They got on a ship that was going to the south of France. And then she lived the rest of her life in the south of France, gave birth to a daughter who was a pretty little girl with reddish hair, and named her Sarah. And that Sarah, the daughter, she became the cornerstone of the Merovingian royalty of France. And that continues. And someone who appears in our Jesus in India movie is Suzanne Olsen. And Suzanne Olsen is part of that lineage from Mary Magdalene and Jesus, and the daughter named Sarah. So she's part of that lineage. We'll talk more about that later, but it's amazing, and I think that is true. I believe it's really true that there are two lineages of the progeny, from Mary Magdalene and from Marianne in Kashmir. And we'll go on here. This is the Jagannath Temple that's the 2,500-year-old building, the Jagannath Temple at Puri. This is the more modern building, the white one. And this is where young Jesus was a student for about 6 years. Sai Baba of India confirmed that Jesus had lived in India. And we go, I'll put it back here. Let me see here. Back to, we were at...
You have evidence of him living in Varanasi.
He is, we interviewed the Shankaracharya of Puri, and the Shankaracharya of Puri, who's like the Pope of Hinduism, told us, that in the student records, in the roster of the students who have attended the Jagannath Temple, that he was one of the students from 2,000 years ago. And they certainly have traditions about him. They certainly talk about him and some of the wonders, some of the wonderful things that he did as he was a teenager there at the Jagannath Temple. There are other, throughout India, and if you'll get my books, you can read in much more detail about all of the evidence, all of the material. There are manuscripts, there are stone carvings, inscriptions, there are traditions, folklore. There's a lot of evidence, really a huge amount of evidence, throughout that part of the world, throughout India, throughout Nepal and Tibet. And it's a subject that the Tibetans know about also. Not necessarily the Tibetans can talk about it, such as the Dalai Lama. We met the Dalai Lama. The Dalai Lama appears in our movie. And we've talked with older Tibetans who have told us that when they were boys, when they were younger people, young monks training in the 1950s before the 1959 Red Chinese takeover of Tibet, they said that at some of their meetings, when they were being trained to be Buddhist monks, that the Dalai Lama himself talked with them, the head monk, the Dalai Lama, that he talked with them in Tibetan language, and the subject came up at various times about, was Jesus in India? Most assuredly. And he was in Nepal and he was in Tibet. So the Dalai Lama discussed it, but the thinking is, if you're the head of one religion, you're not going to rock the boat of another religion. In other words, the head of the Tibetan Buddhist, the Dalai Lama, even though he has that knowledge about Jesus in India and Tibet and so on like that, it's not considered kosher, not considered appropriate for him to talk about it any more than it would be for the Pope to say something to Mormons or be disrespectful to Muslims or Hindus or Buddhists or anyone. That's kind of this unwritten rule. But the Dalai Lama does know about it. And in fact, we were told the document that he saw was at Lhasa Zorpa Archives there in Lhasa before the Chinese invaded. Amazing material. This writer, Janet Bach, she and her husband, they're devotees of Sai Baba, the Talmud of Emmanuel. This is a document which means the spiritual teachings of Jesus, of Emmanuel, the one with godly wisdom. And this is in connection with a UFO case from Switzerland, the Billy Meyer case. Edward Albert Meyer, and his nickname is Billy Meyer. And Billy Meyer, since childhood, he has had human teachers, extraterrestrial human teachers from the Pleiades star system. And what they told him that they talked a lot about hidden history, including a lot of material about Jesus in India. And one of the things they told him about, here's Billy Meyer in Switzerland, and Billy Meyer, I believe now he's in his 80s, I think. And Billy Meyer, I've met one of his children, his son Methuselah. The Billy Meyer material, spiritual teachings are the teachings from the Pleiadians. I think it's wonderful material. Light Years by Gary Kinder, I think it's a really good book, a very well written, easy to read book. It explains the story, the Billy Meyer contactee story, very well. When he was about 5 years old, and he and his father saw a big silvery disc moving through the sky in Switzerland. And Billy later began having experiences where that a spaceship would land in the woods at night behind the house, and he'd get up and put on his bathrobe and go out there into the woods and have meetings with these benevolent men and women, these extraterrestrials from the Pleiades. The Talmud of Emmanuel, we'll get to this. This is what the ships in the Billy Meyer case look like. They call them beam ships. This is one of the wonderful ladies from the Pleiades, and this was Semyase was her name, or is her name. She's still living. This was a beam ship, and it's about 7 meters in diameter, and it's made from a metal alloy, which is made by a cold fusion process. You know what cold fusion is, as opposed to heating up metals and melting them and having them all jumbled together. Cold fusion process, as I understand it, involves, they don't explain. We're not ready to know about cold fusion, or for that matter, we're not really ready to know about travel through hyperspace. And the Pleiadians, there'd be like three of them with a beam ship like this, high up in the atmosphere, outside of the Earth's, I should say in space, outside of the Earth's atmosphere, would be the mothership, which was a huge round craft. And aboard the mothership, in some of the flat hangars, the areas inside of the mothership, there'd be dozens of these beam ships. But in the they have the ability, with their ships, they have the ability to travel. They have two different propulsion systems. The one system is sublight speed, and they're able to build up the multiples. It's kind of like a boy on a donkey with the long stick with a carrot at the end. And if you, for example, to make an analogy, you put two carrots out there, you go twice as fast. And you put 3 carrots, 4 carrots, 5, 100 carrots, and the faster you go, I mean, just to make an example. Well, they are able to project, as I understand, project multiple gravities outside. And, of course, their craft, like the donkey, never catches up with the carrot on the end of the stick that the boy is holding, because it's always out in front, you see? And the multiples of gravity being projected, they keep accelerating. And they have a system aboard where they generate their own gravitational field. There's no inertia. So they could even do a sharp right turn, and nothing gets thrown around. They don't need seat belts. They've got no inertia aboard their craft, unlike our cars and airplanes and so on. But another thing, too, about it, when they reach about 3.5 hours, they're almost at light speed, 186,000 miles per second, almost there. They say if you cross through light speed in a physical craft, it's disaster. Everything blows up. Everything is destroyed. But what they do, right before they cross over into light speed, they change everything, the craft, their bodies, everything they have, they change it into an energy configuration, attach it to tachyons, and send the tachyons into hyperspace. So right before they reach light speed, they change everything into an energy configuration attached to the tachyons, and they have it sent through a navigational device. It goes to their destination, goes through hyperspace. So it takes, and to go the 500 light years from here to the Pleiades, they say it takes, it's a tiny fraction, maybe 1/25th of a second, like a flash of light, like a light bulb, like that, and they're there. And then they slow down for about 3.5 hours from close to light speed. They come back into their physical configuration and slow down. You see how it works? And Billy's teacher for a number of years was some colleagues of the Pleiadians and from a different extraterrestrial group. And the lady from that group is called Asket. And Asket was telling Billy about this Talmud of Emmanuel document, that if Billy would go, this was an Isa Rashid, who had been a Greek Orthodox priest, and he was a friend of Billy Meyer, and in the Middle East, this is some more, here we go. But in the Middle East, they were at the Let me jump over here. Maybe I jumped over. But in the Middle East, they were in Israel, and here's some of the locations there: Dome of the Rock, the Wailing Wall over here, and this may have been the location of Golgotha, the crucifixion, and let me go back over here. Oh, it went off. Let me go over here. This is the Hinnom Valley, the south side of the old walled city of Jerusalem. And at this location right here on the, this is the north, I'm sorry, yeah, this is the south side of the Hinnom Valley. This is facing north that way. But Billy and Issa Rashid were told if they'd go to a certain place on the side of there of the valley, it's more like a big canyon, and they were told they could look and find about a 1 foot diameter hole in the side of the hillside, and they could enlarge that and they could go in, and they did. They found that there was a bush there beside it called a merimee bush, and the merimee bush, that's one of the pollens, incidentally, on the Shroud of Turin, merimee bush. But they found a merimee bush there. They went inside, they enlarged it, and they looked with their flashlights, and it was the size of a small room, maybe about as big as two Volkswagen minibuses put together side by side, and they could stand up in there, and Askett had told them beforehand to pick up the flat stones on the floor and look for a cavity, and they did, and they found a stone box with a stone lid, and they took that out, and they took the lid off, and inside there were Aramaic scrolls in preservative resin. They took that and deciphered it. They were able to get a translation from the Aramaic into German and later into English. And that is where the Talmud of Emmanuel scroll comes from. This is the tomb of Joseph of Arimathea. And you see the front entrance, and from that front entrance, the big stone could be rolled in front of it. And here was the back tunnel entrance. We're looking down from the top. But that was the entrance that Billy Meyer and Issa Rashid went in. And the according to the Talmud of Emmanuel, it's fascinating, it's a beautiful account, what happened that night after the body of Jesus had been, Pontius Pilate had given permission, the body of Jesus had been taken down from the cross, and they had quickly carried the body over there and put it on a stone shelf inside of here, then rolled the big stone over the entrance. And then the story is, the Talmud of Emmanuel says that Joseph of Arimathea, by prearrangement, got together with several healers from India, and they came in here through the back tunnel entrance, and they ministered to Jesus for 3 days and nights. And that out the front side, this is where the Roman soldiers and the other soldiers who were doing guard duty were able to sit around the campfire at night, and they could not see people coming or going out of the back tunnel entrance. There's a wonderful passage in the Talmud of Emmanuel telling how that after Jesus and the helpers had left through the back tunnel entrance, that it was still before daylight, it was dark, and that a Pleiadian beam ship came down, and the beam ship landed in front of the campfire in that area, and the Pleiadians and one of the Pleiadians, a leader named Gabriel, that he came out, and his clothing, his white robes were glowing, and he was giving off, and with his hands he was able to give off like something you see people doing in Star Wars, you know, some of the Jedi, you know, or something like that, giving off, projecting light and giving off light. And in the Talmud of Emmanuel, they call it the Sohar, S-O-H-A-R. They say there is a divine light which can be accessed by very spiritual beings, and that divine white light is called the Sohar. And they said that Archangel Gabriel, or Gabriel, who was one of the Pleiadian commanders, that he was giving off the light of the Sohar, and it was intensely bright light. And the wise men from the Orient, these are some passages from the Talmud of Emmanuel, and they're telling about, mentioning here about Herod Antipas, that I mentioned about before, and about Jesus walking on the, it's hard to see, hard to read this, I understand, but Jesus walking on the water, walking on the Sea of Galilee. And this is the real thing. This is in the Philippines. This is a crucifixion around Easter time. And there are people, and I'm told in some places in Mexico this happens also around Easter. But this is a place in the Philippines where there are people who actually ask to be nailed to a cross. And I'm told that this particular man, that years ago, that in a fit of rage, he killed his wife and children. And he was sent to prison, and then years later, when he was released from prison, every time after that at Easter, he goes there and requests to be crucified. And they crucify him with the nails, they raise the cross up, they raise the cross up, and then he's on the cross, or these other people are on the cross for 15 or 20 minutes. And the reason that I tell about this is that afterwards, when they lower the cross and they take the nails out, almost always the people recover. They recover from that. So their legs were not broken. There was no other serious injury other than the nails, and then in the case of Jesus, the superficial cut to the hip. And this is telling an ancient account telling about how that this was by Flavius Josephus, the famous historian, telling about a man that he knew who was crucified, was taken down from the cross and survived. And then Jesus was saying, "I will not be killed, but being in a state of near death, I will be considered dead for 3 days and nights. I'll be placed in a rock tomb so that the sign of Jonah will be fulfilled." And you know, Jonah went into the whale, into the mouth of the whale, and after 3 days and nights, the whale went to the shore and let Jonah out. Jonah came out alive from 3 days and three nights in the mouth of the whale. And Jesus said that his sign, "My friends from faraway India, who are well-versed in the art of healing, will be my caretakers and help me flee from the tomb on the third day so that I will finish my mission with people of India. It will happen. I will attain a certain insight, increase my knowledge, and bring about a new state of spirit and consciousness." But the Pleiadians, by the way, in the Billy Meyer case, that document, this is a prophecy that's telling about the Israelites had plundered this land through rapaciousness and murder and so on like that. Love will grow cold in many people. Hatred will rule all over the world, and evil will reign. And it's basically here he's giving a description about flying machines and shooting rockets and bombs, rockets, missiles, high explosives, and things like that in this future world. Let me go here. But I mentioned about this book, Celestial Teachings by Dr. Jim Deardorff, is a verse-by-verse comparison between the verses in Matthew, the traditional book of Matthew, and the Talmud of Emmanuel. and all of the logic and the reasons, the explanation about why Matthew was censored and altered, things cut out, things put in more than 200 places. And when you compare the Talmud of Emmanuel passage with the Matthew passage, and you see that the Talmud of Emmanuel, it really, really has the ring of truth again and again and again, the ring of truth. It's like reading Matthew, what the Bible, the New Testament scholars call Proto-Matthew, the original book of Matthew. But it's a wonderful book, and you can get that online if you're interested. Celestial Teachings, very well written. The Pleiadians mentioned, by the way, about the Talmud of Emmanuel. They say, in their opinion, it's the most important. They believe that it's the most important and valuable book an earth human can own and study. And that's a pretty powerful endorsement. The most valuable and important book an earth human can own and study, the Talmud of Emmanuel. And you can find it. It's on my business cards. You can get the website for Dr. Deardorff, tjresearch.info. And but you can get it through Amazon.com or through other sources online. You can read in my books about how to get it. And these are some close friends of mine that up at Laramie, Wyoming, at the Rocky Mountain UFO Conference. And I'm going to be seeing Helen and Barbara. Barbara Lamb is a crop circle expert, probably the best crop circle expert. Helen Billings is a hypnosis therapist. George Cruz is a photographer out in California. But we're all up at the Rocky Mountain UFO Conference during the 1990s. And Leo gave us a trance reading in which he said the four of us have had dozens and dozens of past lifetimes together. And we have a long tradition. We've been usually either holy people or we've been warriors, military people, but many past lifetimes together. And I'm going to just be going ahead. Here's Leo Sprinkle that I mentioned about. I talked to them about 1 week ago on the phone, and he and his wife live up in Laramie, Wyoming. He told me that he's really retired now and does not do trance readings or hypnosis work anymore. He's in his 80s. But he's a very spiritual individual, and he's been a good friend of mine through the years. Since about 1992, I've known Leo, and just a wonderful spiritual individual. Here's a drawing of what Jesus may have really looked like, that he had how the nose really may have looked, and that his hair was a reddish color. His beard and mustache reddish, blue eyes, blue-gray. What's that? This comes from the Billy Meyer case, from the Pleiadians. The Pleiadians gave drawings to Billy Meyer, and also it's a little hard to believe, but in the 1950s, Billy Meyer did time travel with one of his teachers, Ascot. And Ascot took him in the beam ship, and I don't begin to understand how time travel is done, but they can travel either backwards or forwards in time. And what they basically did was that it was in 1957, Semyasi had said, "Would you like to meet Emmanuel, and I'll give you the language translator to have on your belt, and you can talk with him." And he said, yes, he'd like that. They went back to 32 A.D., 1 year before the crucifixion, to the Garden of Gethsemane. I don't know all the details about, maybe this was prearranged, but Jesus, Ascot said that Jesus and some of his followers are coming along the trail here into the garden, and they did. He said that Jesus was about 6 foot one. He was considerably taller than most of the other people, and that he was strong, stocky, and that his voice was of good quality and clarity, and that Billy Meyer spoke with him. They talked for about an hour. They sat down on rocks and talked for about an hour. And but I've read the manuscript of that conversation, and it was a wonderful conversation. And Emmanuel, Jesus, was saying that it grieved. He knew at that time in 32 A.D. he knew what would happen 2,000 years in the future, and he was saying that it grieved him. It grieves him that his teachings, his true teachings, would be greatly distorted and twisted, and that there are. He said that there are many future people in the Christian religion, both Protestant and Catholic, many people who will call loudly on his name and make money from his name, but their hearts will be far from him. That's what he was saying. He knows that the Christianity will become big business. And the Shankaracharya Puri said the same thing. Religion has become big business and big money. And is sad about that. But I encourage everyone that this may be Christ, Ancient American Magazine, that Jesus may have been here after the crucifixion. At some point, he may have been here in America. There's a wonderful book called He Walked the Americas by L. Taylor Hansen. 40 and Times Magazine about Jesus in India. And you see with the four arms and so on, like Shiva. I love that. And we got permission from the artist to adapt that and use that as the cover, the new cover of my first book, the new printing, King of Travelers. And the last thing that I would show was this image right here this is a painting that was made in the 1930s, and it was unveiled in New York City. And when it was unveiled, the story is someone in the audience in New York City walked over and they said to the artist, "You made a mistake, because here on the painting there's no doorknob or latch with which to open the door." And that the artist smiled and said to everyone, "There's no mistake. There is no doorknob or latch, because this is the door of the human heart, and it can only be opened from inside." So Jesus is knocking at the door of the human heart, but it can only be opened from the inside. And I encourage everyone about spiritual growth. I think we're all trying to do that. The Talmud of Emmanuel says that the great choice that we all have is how we want to conduct our life, how we choose to conduct our life. But my understanding about the spiritual teachings is that the reason that we're in a human body is to have the opportunities to grow spiritually, to gain wisdom and knowledge and to grow spiritually, and that spiritual growth is our most important focus.